This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. In this hour, there will be some Norwegian stories. Then there will be an Irish short story called The Fourth Wise Man. Then the fifth in the series of St. Charles by the Bay. If you haven't heard the others, don't worry, they do stand on their own. And we'll conclude with a Russian story called The Iron Winter. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Kurt Benrud, Mark Anderson, and I are going to give the Norwegian take on Christmas. A little bit of facts and a couple of stories. Imagine living in Scandinavia, say, 1,000 years ago. At solstice, the sun rises at about 9 a.m. It sets about 3 p.m., a mere 6 hours of daylight. Even if you sleep for 8 hours, you spend much more of your waking time in darkness than in light. What a relief when the days begin to lengthen again. Many of the ancient traditions surrounding Yuletide are concerned with coping with the darkness and the evils it was thought to harbor, and helping the return of light and warmth. Take holly, for instance. Evergreens were cherished at this time of year as a natural symbol of rebirth and life amid winter whiteness. But holly was particularly prized to decorate doors, windows, and fireplaces because of its prickliness, to either ward off or snag and capture evil spirits before they could enter and harm a household. Sort of like flypaper for fairies. Now, if you scratch the surface of Christmas folklore in Scandinavian countries, you'll find images and traditions that probably go way back. Perhaps this is because Christian missionaries didn't reach these countries until the 10th and 11th centuries, so the old traditions had longer to settle in. There's the Yule Buck, or Yule Goat, from Sweden and Norway, who makes his beginnings as a carrier for the thunder god Thor. Now he earns his keep by carrying the Yule Elf when he makes his rounds to deliver presents and receive his offering of porridge. I've even read somewhere that the Finnish version of this goat character, the Yulapukki, does the present deliveries himself, riding on a bicycle. Yule is from the Old Norse, which means wheel, as it is a symbol that the year has turned. Falling on a solstice, it marks the start of the new year in both Norse and Roman times. At Yule, the god is traditionally born by the goddess, a divine birth. This is the time of year when the day is short and the night is long. Candles are lit to welcome back the returning light of the sun ahead. The sun, a symbol of the god, renews itself from the dark symbol of death. In pagan lore, this is the time when the Oak King, a symbol of divine rebirth, overpowers the Holly King, a symbol of death. Celebrated items for Yule include the decorated evergreen tree, the Yule log, and the exchange of gifts. However, some who have studied the linguistics tell me that the association of Yule with wheel, a fond belief you will find in many places since the words are nearly identical, is a myth. The roots of the two words have about as much similarity in Scandinavian languages as in English. According to one theory, the root word for Yule came from the Aboriginal Scandinavians and has always meant only one thing, the festival at the winter solstice. The word for wheel came from the Indo-Europeans, who migrated to Scandinavia around 3800 BC, although they didn't begin to use the wheel even until about 2500 BC. The debate points out how ancient the word is. For ancient Germanic and Celtic people, the impulse to celebrate solstice was the same as for their neighbors to the south, a celebration of the cycle of nature and a reaffirmation of the continuation of life. But the style and substance of their celebrations took very different shape. It isn't hard to figure out why. These northern cultures survived a colder, darker winter for one thing, and they were just as likely to be herders and hunters as farmers. It's cold, it's dark more hours than light, and snows cover the fields where your herds might forage. What is there to do but make a delight of necessity, with a great slaughter and feasting? And what better time to do it than at the point at which the sun's return is imminent? In Scandinavian mythology, there is the legend of the thunder oak. When the heathen raged through the forests of the ancient Northland, there grew a giant tree branching with huge limbs toward the clouds. It was the thunder oak of the war god Thor. Thither, under cover of night, heathen priests were wont to bring their victims, both men and beasts, and slay them upon the altar of the thunder god. There in the darkness was wrought many an evil deed, while human blood was poured forth and watered the roots of that gloomy tree, from whose branches depended the mistletoe, the fateful plant that sprang from the blood-fed veins of the oak. So gloomy and terror-ridden was the spot on which grew the tree that no beasts of field or forest would lodge beneath its dark branches, nor would birds nest nor perch among its gnarled limbs. Long, long ago, on a white Christmas Eve, Thor's priests held their winter rites beneath the thunder oak. Through the deep snow of the dense forest hastened throngs of heathen folk, all intent on keeping the mystic feast of the mighty Thor. In the hush of the night, the folk gathered in the glade where stood the tree. Closely they pressed around the great altar stone under the overhanging boughs where stood the white-robed priests. Clearly shone the moonlight on all. Then from the altar flashed upward the sacrificial flames, casting their lurid glow on the straining faces of the human victims awaiting the blow of the priest's knife. But the knife never fell, for from the silent avenues of the dark forest came the good Saint Winfred and his people. Swiftly the saint drew from his girdle a shining axe. Fiercely he smote the thunder oak, hewing a deep gash in its trunk. And while the heathen folk gazed in horror and wonder, the bright blade of the axe circled faster and faster around Saint Winfred's head, and the flakes of wood flew far and wide from the deepening cut in the body of the tree. Suddenly there was heard overhead the sound of a mighty rushing wind. A whirling blast struck the tree. It gripped the oak from its foundations. Backward it fell like a tower, groaning as it split into four pieces. But just behind it, unharmed by the ruin, stood a young fir tree, pointing its green spire to heaven. Saint Winfred dropped his axe and turned to speak to the people. Joyously his voice rang out through the crisp winter air. "This little tree, a young child of the forest, shall be your holy tree tonight. It is the tree of peace, for your houses are built of fir. It is the sign of endless life, for its leaves are forever green. See how it points upward toward heaven. Let this be called the tree of the Christ child. Gather about it, not in the wild wood, but in your own homes. There it will shelter no deeds of blood, but loving gifts and rites of kindness. So shall the peace of the white Christ reign in your hearts. and with songs of joy, the multitude of heathen folk took up the little fir tree and bore it to the house of their chief, and there with goodwill and peace they kept the holy Christmastide. Also from Norway is Mette's Christmas Miracle by Harrison Woodard. A long time ago, there was a flock of sparrows. They lived near a small farming village in Norway. Just before Christmas, it started snowing. For 2 days, the blizzard raged, covering everything and making it impossible for the birds to leave their tree. The flock began to worry. "What are we going to do? If the snow continues, we will never find anything to eat," said Marcus. "Maybe we should have flown south with the other birds," said Lena. "We have always survived the winter here. We will survive this one as well," said Jonas, one of the older sparrows. Meta listened to the older birds. If Jonas was not worried, she wouldn't worry either. She found a warm spot and fell asleep. For 2 more days, the snow continued. The flock became even more concerned. "I don't understand. The weather has never been this bad for so long. I don't know if we will make it," said Jonas. Now that Jonas was starting to worry, even Meta was concerned. Before she went to bed, she asked God for help. "Dear God, I know you will provide for all we need. Thank you for protecting us," prayed Meta. The next day, the birds peered out at the raging storm. It was a dismal sight. The snow and the wind made it impossible to fly anywhere. "Jonas, what will we do?" asked Marcus. "Will the storm ever end?" asked Lena. "I think we are in trouble. Even if the storm ends, it may be weeks before we can find any food. The snow will be too deep. It will cover everything," said Jonas. All the birds were very sad. There didn't seem to be any hope. Meta listened to everything the other birds said. As the youngest of her flock, she rarely would say anything, but she knew now she had to say something. "Don't you believe God will take care of us?" asked Meta. "He always has given us everything we needed. Why wouldn't he keep his promise now?" The other birds admired Meta's faith, but they saw the snow and heard the howling wind and saw no way God could save them. "Meta, God has many things he has to do. He can't always save us. Sometimes it is up to us to save ourselves," said Jonas. The other birds agreed. Meta lay down and thought about what Jonas said. "God, that just doesn't make any sense," she prayed softly. "I know that you will supply everything we need. I am going to trust you and not the other sparrows." The next day was Christmas Eve. The weather outside was the worst it had ever been. The snow was coming down so hard that you couldn't see more than a couple of feet. There was absolutely no way the flock could leave their tree. The sparrows gathered together to discuss their options. "I don't think I can last another day," said Marcus. "I'm very hungry." "Me too," added Lena. "I just don't know what to do," said Jonas. They had all lost hope. Off in the village came the faint sound of Christmas bells. The sparrows listened to the music. It was very pretty and brought a brief moment of relief to their despair. After the bells stopped, the birds sat in silence. After a long pause, Meta spoke. "Do you hear the bells? This is Christmas Eve, the night God gave his son. If he's willing to give his own son, he will certainly provide our food." The other sparrows wanted to believe, but all they could see was the raging blizzard. They saw no way that God could provide anything for them. "Marcus, don't you believe?" asked Meta. Marcus thought for a second. "I believe I do." That night Meta bowed her head and prayed. "God, thank you for giving Jesus to the world. I know that you love my flock and will provide everything we need." Meta found a warm spot in the tree and fell asleep. It was another long, cold night. The next morning, Marcus was the first to wake up. He felt the warm sun on his feathers and took off on a short flight to stretch his wings. The snow had stopped, and it was a sunny Christmas morning. Marcus flew over the village and was surprised by what he saw. He immediately flew back to the tree. "Meta, wake up! Wake up! It's a miracle!" shouted Marcus. "Everyone, come quickly!" Soon the whole flock was following Marcus toward the village. During the night, the people had placed sheaves of oats on poles and rooftops throughout the village. There was plenty of food for everyone. Barn doors, gables, and gateways throughout the village were decorated with grain. There would be plenty of food for the whole flock all winter. "Just like you said, Meta, God will provide everything we need," said Marcus. "I will never again doubt God." That day the sparrows celebrated Christmas by feasting on all the food they had gathered. Never again would any of them ever doubt God's ability to provide everything they needed. And from that day forward, in villages throughout Scandinavia, people continue to place food out for the birds on Christmas. No human knows exactly why this custom started, but God knows. He was responding to the faith of a little sparrow named Meta. This next piece is a poem written by a Scandinavian named Asto Eriksson. It's in English. It's called Christmas in the Forest. Christmas Day was nearly over. In the forest stood Old Pa Charlie's snowy cottage, as such Christmas cabins should. Through its frosty broken windows, Christmas stars were peeping in on the Christmas tears upon Ma Kelly's bearded cheek and chin. She was shivering and starving, sucking moldy bits of cake, while her shaggy mate sat cursing, dreaming of a Christmas steak. And the Christmas lamp was glowing on a table not too clean, as it burned their last and costly drops of Christmas kerosene. Nothing much there was to listen to of Christmas sound or noise, just Ma Kelly's Christmas crying and Pa Charlie's rusty voice. In the courtyard could be heard a swearing bullfinch, mad and sore, in a Christmas sheaf from yesteryear, or even that before. "Listen, jingly bells are sounding. There is Christmas peace no more. They get noisier and noisier until they reach the door. Merry Christmas steps approaching. Are they those of Santa Claus? Not at all, it wasn't Santa. You'll know shortly who it was. In the doorway, highly sozzled by too many Christmas beers, stands a furry, fattish chap who through his frosty glasses peers. He's the old one's oldest offspring, and their blackest sheep, one fears, and from whom they hadn't heard a word for more than 20 years. Now he whispers, Ma and Pa, and starts to holler Christmas songs, shedding floods of Christmas tears, because he's back where he belongs. From his sleigh he now produces an enormous Christmas trunk, full of Christmas grub and Christmas booze and lots of Christmas junk. From this Christmas plenty, Ma and Pa were free to pick and choose. They stuffed themselves with lots of Christmas food and lots of Christmas booze. And their long-lost son eventually added to their thrift when they could replace their worn-out teeth with new ones as a gift. All was silent in the cottage, only belching could be heard. Also Christmas moans and Christmas groans and yawning there occurred, until Ma, a little tipsy, clean forgot her aching back and performed a Christmas jump that nearly wrecked the Christmas shack. Now as dawn is soon approaching, let us leave the three in peace. It's time to let this silly Christmas carol end and cease. Over Christmas joy and fun, we let the Christmas curtain fall. We have seen the happy ending. It was Christmas, after all.
Hi, this is Mark Anderson, and I'm going to be reading some reflections by a writer named Astrid Carlson Scott on some Norwegian Christmas traditions around Norway's legendary Nisse. Norway's legendary Nisse, the elf who symbolizes Christmas to generations of Norwegians, was born of ancient folk beliefs. Most Norwegians have their own ideas about how Nissen looks and acts, but he is generally thought of as a short, stocky fellow with a long gray beard and a red knitted cap. He usually wears dark knickers and a shirt and vest or a sweater, and his eyes always twinkle with mischief. Today, adults and children alike anticipate the traditional appearance of Nissen with great joy. His visits, when he brings children Christmas gifts and greets everyone warmly, represent the essence of the Christmas season. Without Nissen's presence, generations of Norwegians would think Christmas incomplete. But the role of Nissen wasn't always that of a festive gift-giver. Several decades ago, he was often thought of primarily as the protector of the family farm. In my childhood home in Norway, my parents treasured tradition and storytelling. Because of that, much of what I and other Norwegians know about Nissen came from oral traditions passed down through generations. No one knows for certain how the legend of Nissen started, but over the years, storytellers added their own touches. Therefore, Nissen's characteristics have changed over time, just as Christmas celebrations have evolved. During the early Christmas era and beyond, Norwegians still believed strongly in stories about the netherworld figures, Hillfolk and Nissur. Some believed Nissen was also Rudkallen, or the spirit of a farm's owner who first had cleared the land. As time passed, Nissen became known as the self-appointed protector of the farm. Just as Vikings believed that offering food to their gods would ensure favors in return, farmers believed that Rudkallen would protect them if they treated him well. It's not clear exactly when many Norwegians began naming the mythical figure. They gave the name Tunkal to friendly spirits or elves that belonged to their farms. A Tomtegubben was a little old man or gnome. Those characters were all ancestors of today's Nisse, which many Norwegians still think of as real. It has certainly been about a century and a half since Nissen began bringing gifts to well-behaved children. That tradition probably started with the Bishop St. Nicholas in Myra, Turkey, somewhere around 300 AD. According to the 1966 World Book Encyclopedia, St. Nicholas was revered for his good deeds, and he was credited with many miraculous events. Written accounts don't say what kinds of miracles he performed, though. After his death on December 6th, the year of death being unknown, his reputation spread across Europe and his name began to be used in many forms. In fact, today much of Europe observes December 6th as a special holiday in honor of St. Nicholas. In the north, he was given the name Nissen, which is believed to have come from the Danish word nils. Some linguists say that the word is derived from the word Nikolaus. Nissen has always been believed to be diminutive, but his exact height has also changed over the years. At one time, the legend has it that the elf was tiny, only several inches high. But gradually, Nissen's identity perhaps melded a bit with that of Santa Claus, and people came to think that Nissen was the size of a small human. Though small, Nissen was powerful. He seemed to like humans, that is, if he was treated with the respect he felt he deserved. On the farm, he helped with the work in mysterious ways. For example, because he enjoyed helping horses more than cows, He would often steal hay from the cows to give an extra portion to a favorite horse. Most people believed that if Nissen was neglected, especially on Christmas Eve, he would cause havoc throughout the coming year. His trickery could contribute to crop failure and sickness for both animals and people. Sometimes he would even tie the animals' tails together. Nissen expected to be treated well on Christmas Eve. He enjoyed being served large wooden bowls filled with steaming rummergrat, sour cream porridge, with a big smirja, or eye of butter, in the center. Today he prefers rice porridge, but the butter is still a must. Carrying his bowl to the barn on Christmas Eve was the dairymaid's job. In the middle of black winter nights, young maids, nearly scared out of their wits, would rush into the dark, forlorn barns to leave him his treat. The maids often thought that Nissen was watching their every move from behind some dark corner. When the girls went to find the bowls the next morning, the dishes would be licked clean. That surely was proof enough that the creature existed. According to one oral legend, which Norwegian folklore expert Olav Bø recounts in his book Hugadatur og Minnedager, Holidays and Special Days in Norway, a maid in Hallingdal, Norway, had little faith in Nissen. So instead of bringing his porridge to the barn, she ate it herself. When the girl later went to the barn to milk the cow, Nissen appeared before her and mockingly said, "So, you don't believe in the Nissa? Then you shall dance with the Nissa." He then took her hands and began to swing her around. The maid could not break free. When Nissen finally let her go, she fell ill, and she never recovered. Norwegian folklore scholar P.C. Asbjørnsen recounts a similar version of that story in his book An Old-Fashioned Christmas. When that story spread across Norway, other dairymaids decided they better continue to brave the dark and cold and bring the feisty elf his porridge, and the custom has persisted. During my youth in Norway, we children felt as though we knew Nissen personally, which was probably true. Most families in Norway have an uncle, cousin, or father who transforms himself, with the help of a stiff mask and a costume, into Nissen on Christmas Eve. Mysteriously enough, the man will disappear moments before the family hears the long-awaited knock on the door. Then the Nissa, with his sack, enters the doorway. The family ushers him in with great ceremony, and the elf then asks the question that Nisser have asked Norwegian children for generations. "Good evening. Good evening. Are there any good children here?" "Yes, I am good," most children say, perhaps fibbing a bit. The youngsters often tremble with a mixture of joy and uneasiness, hoping to measure up to Nissen's expectations. During my youth, it never seemed to matter what Nissen brought, but only that he came. Usually he stayed for just a few minutes because many other children were waiting for him. Later in the evening, we might catch another glimpse of him when he returned to fill the stockings. If not, we took comfort in goodies he left during the night, such as an orange, a marzipan pig, a pair of mittens, or perhaps a book. Today, commercialism has invaded Norway, as in all Western countries. Many children are familiar only with the department store version of Nissen, to whom children tell their wishes. Yet most Norwegians know, deep in their heart, that the true Nissa lives. Though his mannerisms and size have changed through the ages, the Norwegian infatuation with Nissen continues to burn bright. That is why, across Norway, Norwegians still fill wooden bowls with porridge and take them to their barns on Christmas Eve, because no one can be quite sure.
This is Kurt Benrud, and I'm going to read The Cat of the Dovrefell. It's a Norwegian folk tale. A long time ago, a Norwegian named Orman found an orphaned polar bear in a winter cave. He took the cub home and raised it to a full-grown white bear. Traveling throughout the Norse lands with the enormous and powerful bear at his side, Ormund seldom met with trouble. One snowy Christmas Eve, the man and bear began a journey to Denmark. They came to an inn on the Dovrefjell and asked the proprietor, a man named Halvor, for a room. "No rooms tonight," he said, "not for you or your bear. You'll have to keep going." "It's Christmas Eve," said Ormund. "Where's your charity? You can't turn us out on Christmas Eve." "I have no choice," said Halvor with a sigh. "I can't invite you to stay tonight of all nights. You wouldn't survive. No one would." "What do you mean, not survive? There is little in this world that I fear, and the same can be said of my bear." "It's the trolls," explained Halvor. "They come down from the mountain each Christmas Eve. They eat all our food and drink all our drink, and they kill anyone who stays in the inn. My good wife and I prepare a feast for them and leave, just now, as the sun is setting." "If it's trolls that worry you, then worry no more. My bear and I know how to deal with trolls." As Halvor and his wife ran to safety at the nearby village, Ormund and his bear went inside the inn. The tables in the main room lay heavy with scrumptious foods, platters of ham and venison, bowls of carrots and onions, baskets of brown bread and rolls, pies and puddings, and a barrel of apple cider made a Christmas feast fit for the king himself. "It all smells so wonderful," said Ormund, "but this isn't the time to eat. You curl up behind the warm stove, faithful bear, and I'll hide in the closet." It wasn't long before the trolls tramped and stomped down the mountainside, chanting, "Time to eat! Time to eat! Halvor's made our Christmas treat! You'll get bread, I get meat! Time to eat! Time to eat! Time to eat!" They were huge, ugly trolls, with warts on their fat noses and green hair growing out of their droopy ears. Entire troll families arrived. There were old trolls and young trolls, fat trolls and thin ones. Seeing all the food, they grunted and growled and slobbered on the floor. They were hungry. Having no manners, the trolls didn't bother to sit at the table. They grabbed at the food with filthy fingers and shoveled it in, not taking the time to chew. They screamed at each other and gobbled and burped and belched. They broke the crockery and threw rolls and pudding at the walls. One fat piece of venison slipped from a young troll's greasy hand and rolled behind the stove. He ran after it, and just as he grabbed it up, he saw the bear lying there. "Here, little white cat," said the troll in a festive mood. "Do you want a bite?" The polar bear growled and rose up to his full height. He roared with anger and cuffed the little troll across the room, landing him on his behind. Taken by surprise, the rest of the trolls yelled with fright. They all ran from the inn and up the snowy mountainside back to the safety of their cave. Ormund and his bear continued on their journey early the next morning. A year went by. It was Christmas Eve once again, and Halvor was outside his inn drawing water from the well. He heard a strange voice from far away. It was the leader of the trolls calling down from the mountaintop.
"Innkeeper! Innkeeper! Do you still have that big white cat behind the stove?"
"Indeed I do," Halvor lied, "and she's had 6 big kittens who live with her still."
"Then we can't come down for our Christmas feast tonight, not with all those white cats in your house."
The trolls never returned to Halvor's inn on the Dovrefjell, not at Christmas, nor ever again.
Hi, this is Gail O'Neill again, and this is part 5 of St. Charles by the Bay. It always happens at Christmas. He had searched everywhere, every suitcase, every pants and jacket pocket. Nowhere could he find it. Her name and phone number, where was it, and what was her name? He had decided to use the last of his frequent flyer miles before they expired. He thought of Paris and her. The city also reminded him of another time in his life, but he didn't want that to spoil this trip. She had a studio apartment there, she had told him. It was a place where she stayed sometimes and worked on her sculptures. He hadn't forgotten her, and that was unusual for him.
Quite the ladies' man.
He mused to himself, or at least that was the impression most of his acquaintances had about him. He was mostly trying to defend himself from those lonely women, he rolled his eyes with a half-smile. This one was different, though. She was seductive, but shy. She didn't try to capture him, but she had. Her intensely dark eyes and long, dark, shiny hair stayed always in his memory. He normally was attracted to more sinuous, very blonde women, but this one was special and mysterious to him. But what was her name? It would not come to him. In an effort to remember, he thought backward to their beginning. He pushed open the door to his favorite travel agency and plopped down in front of his longtime agent, Maureen. She looked up from the glasses perched on the end of her nose. She knew that look all too well. Uh-oh, was she this time? She asked teasingly. But Charles was in no mood for teasing, even from a friend.
Just book me somewhere far away from here.
He growled brusquely at her unwelcome inquisition. She smiled patiently. I know just the place. It's a small, out-of-the-way spot called Harbor Island, and there's a bed and breakfast on the beach. It isn't very fancy, but the food is excellent. Breakfasts, cooked to order, and 5-course dinners every evening on the veranda overlooking the ocean. It's called Runaway Hill.
Perfect,
he responded.
Sounds like just the place I need to be.
Satisfied that he was bound for his destination, he went home and started packing. The next day he was headed for paradise, without knowing it. After an all-day journey of one mode of travel to another to get to this tiny island, he was exhausted and ready for a nice, quiet evening of listening to the waves and reading a good novel. As he was unpacking, though, his plans in life suddenly changed with a knock on his door.
Who would be bothering me already?
He mumbled to himself.
Must be the help.
He grudgingly opened the door and saw a group of well-dressed, pleasant-looking couples and one lone woman. After introductions and an apology for interrupting him, they asked him to sit with them at their table that evening for dinner. They could squeeze in an extra chair for him. Wanting to appear friendly and liking them already, he told them how kind it was to invite a stranger and he would be delighted to join them. Besides, he was also curious about the lone woman. He could hardly take his eyes off her. After their goodbyes, he looked at his rumpled clothes he had just hung in the closet.
What to wear?
He decided on the new linen casual suit and a pale yellow shirt. That was a good color for him, someone had complimented once. He wasn't sure what the others would be wearing in this quaint place, but that was a nice in-between outfit, he decided. His demeanor had suddenly changed. He slipped into the new suit and felt like a new man as he locked his door and headed to the main house from his bungalow. Hello, hello, and welcome to our table, their smiles greeted him warmly as he approached. He noticed there were 3 empty chairs. When they saw his disappointment, they laughed and assured him that Anaya would be coming shortly. She had a last-minute phone call, they explained. He wondered who was supposed to be in the last spot. He eased his bulk into the padded wicker chair and pretended to be interested in the small talk of those at the table. When he saw her walk onto the veranda, she was so stunning that she took his breath away. The candles and strands of glittering porch lights made her long, straight hair shine even more than he remembered from earlier in the day. Her full, moist mouth matched the coral of her dress, bare-shouldered with a slit on one side to show a very shapely thigh, as she seated herself in the chair next to him. She smiled, but he could tell something was wrong. No one else seemed to notice, but she saw the look of concern in his eyes, and she nodded with a sad smile, her dark eyes connecting with his. After dinner, he asked if she would care to walk on the beach. He was anxious to get her away from all the others and have her to himself. She nodded, took off her heels, and accepted his hand down the steps to the sand. They continued holding hands as they headed away from the main house and the laughter and lights. Quietly, they walked along the water's edge as the waves wrapped around their ankles. He waited patiently for her to tell her story, and finally it came. He said he doesn't love me. The tears started rolling down her face as she looked away from him, hoping he would not see them. He brought out his ever-ready handkerchief and dabbed her face with it. He had been with vulnerable women before and always appeared to be the gentleman in waiting. He looked at her loveliness and couldn't imagine a man not wanting her.
Would you like to stop at the bar and tell me about it?
He asked, as they approached the Pink Sands Hotel on the beach. They found an empty table on the terrace overlooking the ocean. Charles ordered a bottle of Merlot and got ready for a long night of listening, and maybe more. Her words came painfully as he watched her attentively. A story similar to those from other women in his past, and some of his own making, he guiltily thought. But then, he comforted himself, his own heart had also been broken many times. She had met a man, a wealthy builder from Providence in the States, who owned a yacht and sailed into this port every year in August. They had kept in touch from the summer before, planning to be together this year. Then she had a disturbing message from Tom that he was not going to be able to meet her for dinner. After she had called his cell number repeatedly until he finally answered, he admitted that he was on the island with a new young love and would not be seeing Anaya this trip. She became irate at his nonchalance, and she hung up. She was heartbroken and also embarrassed after she had talked of nothing else but coming here to the island to be with the man of her dreams. She had planned to spend the next 3 weeks in his arms. Now, what would she do? Charles knew exactly what she would do. He ached to take her into his own arms, so he asked if she would dance with him to a slow, soft blues, the last song of the night by the house band. She accepted, her story told, her tears wiped away by a new beau who now held her closely. Truth told, they both needed human contact that night and found more than solace in each other's arms, a little magic that washed the tears and loneliness and disappointment away. As the days passed on the island, Charles and Anaya spent their time on the beach inside one of the tents, reading, shopping in the little stores, sunning by the pool. He watched her sketch from behind his sunglasses, never able to get enough of her. They ended every evening dancing and drinking wine at the Pink Sands Hotel. Both well-traveled and colorful people, they had many adventures to share with each other. But one story was an unnerving revelation. She was a married woman. She explained that it was a marriage of convenience, comfortable because both she and her husband had their own lives. He had money and time, and she had beauty and talent, so both were satisfied with the arrangement. This struck a sour note within Charles' Catholic conscience, but he couldn't bear to give her up. Not just yet, anyway. She had an art studio in Paris, she told him, where she stayed sometimes and worked on her sculptures. She was the most beautiful and the most fascinating woman he had ever met, so he forgave her for her flamboyant, unfaithful lifestyle. He no longer felt sorry for her, though. He extended his stay on the island. After all, he was retired, even though he explained over and over that it was an early retirement. In spite of his Catholic reservations, he became entranced with her. When they ran into Tom at their favorite bar one evening, he saw, with a twinge of jealousy, the hurt in Anaya's face when she saw the young, beautiful blonde model hanging onto him. Charles accepted that he was not her first choice. He began to wonder how many choices this married woman had. The doubts and suspicions had already clouded his emotions, but not enough to let her go. Not just yet. The end of the 3 weeks came. They parted as lovers. She went home to Paris and her husband. He went back to the States in, what, early retirement?
Anaya, that's it. Sounds like the wind, mysterious and breathtaking. That is she.
As Charles talked to himself, remembering her name. Now sorry that he hadn't answered her letters over the years, he searched but couldn't find a single one. He looked in an old address book with success, a name and a number, but no address for her. He nervously called the number but quickly hung up when a man answered.
Maybe the husband,
he thought out loud. He felt ashamed for trying to reach her, but in spite of other women in his life the past few years and even a brief marriage, his mind always went back to that summer on the island with Anaya. And in spite of its imperfection, it was the most perfect time of his life. He had even thought of calling her when he was in Paris on his honeymoon.
Pathetic,
he told himself.
No wonder that marriage didn't last.
He laughed ironically as he finished packing the last of his things for the trip. He looked in his closet once more to see if there was anything he forgot. He saw the old linen suit hanging limply on a hanger, and he took it down to pack it for good luck. He felt a small lump in one of the pockets. He reached in and discovered a box of matches that he had taken from the Pink Sands Hotel to light the candles in his room for romantic evenings at Harbor Island. A believer in signs, he knew this was the right thing to do. On to Paris and this destination. But he would not call her number again today. The flight was forever. He always tried to get an aisle seat so that his long legs wouldn't be cramped.
Not worth spending the extra for first class, though,
he surmised. He had never traveled on a holiday before, but he needed to use those air miles. He was proud of his prudent ways. Alone in a foreign city at Christmas, far away from family and familiar places, might not have appealed to many. But for someone alone, it was better than being at home and seeing the happy looks on other faces and pretending to be happy. He wondered if he had retired way too early. He was getting a bit bored with trying to keep busy, but he had these last miles, and he was excited about the adventure and the possibilities. He took a taxi from the airport to his home for 10 days. He had opted for an older hotel with a reasonable rate rather than those for the elite.
I've already been to those places,
as he recollected the many business trips when only the best accommodations would do. Truth be told, he was concerned about his money lasting long enough with his early retirement. He missed the expense accounts already. He looked at his bulging bags and thought of his aching legs and back and decided the services of a bellboy would be worth it today. He set out his toiletries, filled the scant drawers, and hung up his clothes in the closet. He looked at the linen suit. It looked rather pitiful after all these years, plus the plane trip. He put on his jacket and felt in the pockets as he normally did.
What is that?
He pulled out a small piece of paper almost hidden in the fold of the pocket. He had missed it earlier. There was an address written in Anaya's handwriting, another sign. They just kept coming from this old suit. So he put on the pants and the yellow shirt, hoping to replicate that first night on Harbor Island. He was ready to find his future, his final destination. He stopped at the desk for a street guide and asked directions to the address he had found in his pocket. It was within walking distance, and since it was a nice evening for this time of year, he set out to find her studio, his lucky linen suit and all. He forgot about his aching legs and back. When he found the building, the windows were dark. He tried to peek inside, but the shades were tightly drawn. It would have been too easy, he decided, for him to find her today. He thought of a favorite phrase from his father when he was admonishing Charles for giving up too quickly.
It's no hill for a climber.
Well, he would be that climber, but not today. He was certainly in the right country for hills with all the scenic surrounding mountains. Exhaustion had set in from the day's travels as his legs and back suddenly began to ache again, and he hailed a taxi back to the hotel. He entered his room and saw that someone had turned down the bed cover and left a rose and un chocolat on the silk pillowcase. What a nice touch. He was impressed with this old hotel that still kept up appearances, even though it had seen much better times. He put the rose in water and ate the tasty chocolate slowly. Outside his window were the lights of Paris, an adventure, and a hill to climb. He slept very well that night. The next morning he had breakfast in a little cafe, then was on his way back to the address on the paper he carried with him. He thought the stop would calm him, but he didn't. He was anxious to find Anaya. When he got to the building, he was relieved to see that it was open. The bell tinkled as he pushed open the door to go inside. An older gentleman wheeled himself to greet him and show him around the studio. Charles was amazed at the beautiful paintings and sculptures that were on display for sale.
Are all these Anaya's?
He asked the gentleman.
Yes. How do you know her?
The man asked curiously.
We met on a trip.
Charles responded without going into detail.
Yes. You must be a dealer on a buying trip,
he said with relief. Charles nodded.
Is Anaya here? She is at a showing in Italy through today, but should be back by the evening hour. May I give her a name and a number where you can be reached?
Charles gave him the hotel number and his name. He would have to be patient another day, he decided. But at least this was definitely her place. Wanting to know, he asked the gentleman if he were her husband, and the man nodded.
Yes, we have two daughters who are just as beautiful and talented as their mother.
And he showed Charles the photos on the desk. One had dark hair and eyes like Anaya, and the other, much younger child, had light brown hair and hazel eyes. Pointing to her, he smiled and said that she was their joy. Tears welled up in Charles's eyes because she looked exactly like his mother's photo that he had kept with him all these years. Not really knowing what to do or say, he left the shop without another word, hoping his tears had not been spotted. But the gentleman looked through the store window knowingly as Charles walked quickly away from sight. The cold air finally set in, and he pulled his scarf tighter around his neck and over his ears. He was glad for the heavy overcoat, the same camel one he had worn forever that his second wife had given him one Christmas. How many years ago was that? He walked across the misty bridge, heading slowly back to his hotel. He stopped and sat on one of the coal benches and watched the boats for a bit, trying to ward off the melancholy mood that had enveloped him, like the fog was now enveloping the horizon. Suddenly feeling very cold and sad and alone, he crossed the bridge. Pensively, he thought of other bridges, and wished he had not burned so many of them in his past, but had kept them open. He had lost many precious people in his life from pride. When he got back to the hotel, and feeling a little sorry for himself, he stopped in the bar before going up to his room. The bartender listened patiently to story after story as Charles drank glass after glass of wine. Then the kind bartender asked one of the waiters to help him up to his room when Charles had more than enough. He collapsed upon the bed immediately. The red light was blinking on his phone. Normally an early riser, he slept late and was finally awakened by the trilling of the phone. He was too groggy to answer, so mercifully, it finally stopped ringing. Suddenly needing to find the toilet, he stumbled into the small bath and much later found his way slowly back. To the bed and collapsed again. By afternoon, he had regained some sense of balance and was feeling hungry, so he showered, shaved, and put on some fresh clothes. He finally noticed the red light on the phone and picked up the receiver to access his messages. There were four of them. The first was from his sister Doris to wish him a happy holiday and make sure that he was okay.
Nice to have a caring sister,
he thought. The second was from Brianna. She wanted to make sure of the time he would arrive in Dublin for Christmas dinner. Her father Patrick was cooking all his favorites, she told him. Charles had found him after her mother died. He felt like she belonged with her father in her native Ireland. Besides, what did he know about raising children? They had remained close and special to each other, though, and she was one bridge he crossed as often as possible. The next one was a young girl's voice that said, "Hello," but nothing more before she hung up. Then Anaya's still, beautiful, smoky voice was the last message. "Call me, Charles. I want to see you. Thank you for not forgetting me. We have a lot to talk about." And with that welcoming and forgiving message, all the hills and all the bridges suddenly came into place. None were too high to climb, nor too wide to cross.
The Iron Winter and the Raggedy Old Man by Taffy Thomas, read by Megan Mercer-Bourne. The Russian winter of 1910 was the severest in memory. It was so cold that it was known as the Iron Winter. Because of its location, a prosperous and popular hotel some 20 kilometers from Moscow suffered particular loss of business. No one had stayed there for weeks, and the owner had laid off most of his staff. One evening, he was surprised to hear a knock on his front door. Upon opening it, he was confronted by a gray-bearded, raggedy old man. The old man said that he had been out in the snow for several days. He was freezing cold and starving hungry. Could the hotelier give him a meal and a bed for the night?
"I can certainly do that," said the hotelier. "For one night's accommodation plus a meal, the charge is 3 rubles. Can you pay?"
The old man confessed that he had no money, but if he was sent away, he would surely die in the cold. The hotelier felt sorry for the old man and told him to come inside. He took him to the kitchen, where, bubbling away on the stove, was a pot of borscht. The hotelier ladled out a large portion of the borscht, added a twist of sour cream, and, for good measure, gave his visitor half a loaf of rye bread. The raggedy old man was obviously very hungry, and soon disposed of the bread and the soup. The hotelier laughed to see a great beetroot stain along the bottom of the old man's mustache. The raggedy old man thanked the hotelier for the food and said,
"You won't see the going of me in the morning, but although I have no money now, I'll pay you the 3 rubles when I have it."
The hotelier said nothing, but did not expect to see either the 3 rubles or the old man ever again. The snow eventually cleared, and business began to pick up. In fact, the hotel became busier than it had ever been. In the spring, being a devoutly religious man, the hotelier decided to go to the great cathedral in the city to give thanks to God for the hotel's recovery and continued success. Upon arrival in the capital, he made straight for the cathedral. Once inside, he gazed around the interior of the ancient church. His eyes fell upon the many icons that adorned the walls. He was drawn in particular to one image in a far corner. It was painted in the likeness of an old man with a gray beard, and seemed vaguely familiar. As he drew closer, he noticed a dark beetroot stain upon the mustache. He looked at the name inscribed beneath the image. It read, Saint Nicholas. He reached for a candle to place in front of the icon, and as he moved the loose earth into which he would fix the candle, his hand touched something small and hard. It was a coin, a ruble. Beside it were two more. He picked them up and looked again at the icon. The beetroot stain was gone, and the face was smiling.
Santa Claus. The origin of Santa Claus begins in the 4th century with St. Nicholas, Bishop of Myra, an area in present-day Turkey. By all accounts, St. Nicholas was a generous man, particularly devoted to children. After his death around 340 AD, he was buried in Myra, but in 1087, Italian sailors purportedly stole his remains and removed them to Bari, Italy, greatly increasing St. Nicholas's popularity throughout Europe. His kindness and reputation for generosity gave rise to claims that he could perform miracles, and devotion to him increased. St. Nicholas became the patron saint of Russia, where he was known by his red cape, flowing white beard, and bishop's mitre. In Greece, he is the patron saint of sailors. In France, he was the patron of lawyers. And in Belgium, the patron of children and travelers. Thousands of churches across Europe were dedicated to him, and sometime around the 12th century, an official church holiday was created in his honor. The Feast of St. Nicholas was celebrated December 6th, and the day was marked by gift-giving and charity. After the Reformation, European followers of St. Nicholas dwindled, but the legend was kept alive in Holland, where the Dutch spelling of his name, Sint Nicolaas, was eventually transformed to Sinterklaas. Dutch children would leave their wooden shoes by the fireplace, and Sinterklaas would reward good children by placing treats in their shoes. Dutch colonists brought this tradition with them to America in the 17th century, and here the Anglican name of Santa Claus emerged.